Welcome to your deep dive. Today, we're going to try to unpack this idea of, how something as simple as, yes, I'll buy it,
Right.
can actually get really complicated
Yeah.
when you're doing business internationally. So we're talking offer and acceptance, but with a global twist.
Absolutely. And when you're doing business across borders, all that fine print, well, it gets even finer.
Exactly. Now, you were sharing some notes from a business law lecture.
Yeah.
And honestly, I felt like I was reading a legal thriller. Some of these real-world
Oh,
examples is
yark.
just crazy.
Yeah, well, it's scary how easily things can go wrong, but thankfully they also show us how to kind of, avoid those pitfalls.
Okay, so let's start with this thing called the mirror acceptance rule,
Yes.
which the lecture explains using a Dell computer purchase.
Right?
And it's just wild how, even a tiny detail, like the color of the computer housing, can totally derail a contract.
This is one of those things where meticulous attention to detail is just absolutely crucial, especially when you're dealing with these really lengthy specifications. Think of it this way. If your acceptance doesn't perfectly reflect the offer, a court might just say, well, there was no true meeting of the minds. And poof, no contract.
So it's almost like a legal game of spot the difference, right?
Yes. And you would be surprised how often these little differences can just pop up,
Brilliant.
especially when you add in language barriers. Now, the lecture actually mentions this case where a contract was written in Spanish, but the word ordenador caused like a major, major confusion.
Really?
See, in some places, ordenador means a counting machine, not a computer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So even if the wording seems straightforward on its face,
Yeah.
you can still run into trouble if you're not using the right terminology for the specific region or market that
Oh,
you're dealing
surely,
with.
yeah. And that actually leads to another really, really important point. Relying on things like Google Translate
Oh, yeah.
for contracts, incredibly risky. The lecture even mentions these, mom and pop stores trying
Yeah.
to use these tools, and they end up in legal hot water.
It's a bit like trusting your GPS blindly,
Oh,
when
yeah.
you're in a foreign city.
Oh, yeah.
You might end up somewhere completely unexpected.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you mentioned the global aspect, and that actually brings us to another potential pitfall in time zones. Something as simple as, like close of business
Right.
can become a legal headache.
Right. Like in the lecture, they use this example
Yeah.
involving Baltimore and Honolulu. So if a contract says an offer is valid until close of business,
Right.
but it doesn't say what time zone.
Yeah.
Is it 5 p.m. in Baltimore or is it like 2 p.m. in Honolulu? And suddenly a simple deadline, well, it's not so simple anymore.
No, it's a gray area. And this is where clarity and precision, they become just so important. You always have to specify the exact time zone
Oh.
for any deadlines or any important dates.
So even something like next Wednesday could be a
Funny.
problem
Absolutely.
if you're dealing with people on opposite sides of the planet.
Yeah. You want to eliminate any room for, interpretation. Imagine the confusion if one party thinks they have until Wednesday in their time zone,
Right.
while the other party considers the deadline to have already passed.
Oh, man. Now, the lecturer also talks about this thing called a naked offer, which I found fascinating.
Okay.
So it basically means a seller can, pull back their offer before it's accepted, even if they've set a deadline.
And this might seem a little unfair at first, but it's really important to remember the commercial realities, that are at play here. Sellers often just need flexibility,
Yeah.
especially when they have limited supplies and multiple potential buyers.
Okay, so even if a seller says this offer is good until Friday at 5 p.m.,
Yeah.
they could still change their mind before then.
That's right. It's kind of like, imagine a shop owner reserving the right to sell an item to someone else, even if you've, expressed interest. But don't worry, there are ways buyers can protect themselves. The lecture mentions these things called option contracts.
Ah, so it's like paying a little fee
Yeah. Yikes.
to reserve the item,
Yeah.
guaranteeing you've got the right to buy it
Yeah.
within a certain time frame.
Precisely. So you're essentially buying time
Right.
by giving some kind of consideration, like you said, a fee or earnest money.
That makes a lot of sense. It gives the buyer some peace of mind knowing the offer is secure,
Yeah.
at least for a certain period of time.
Now let's move on to another interesting concept, commercially reasonable time. This comes into play when an offer doesn't have like a specific deadline,
Okay, so if a seller just says, "Hey, I'm interested in selling you these widgets,"
Yeah.
how long does the buyer have to accept?
Well, this is where things get a little more nuanced. Courts look at all sorts of factors, like the usual way the parties do business, industry norms,
Okay.
and even what kind of goods are
Oh,
involved.
right.
Yeah.
The lecture mentioned that the shelf life of the goods plays a role.
Yes.
An offer for something perishable, like fish or tomatoes, that's only going to be valid for a very short time.
That's a great example. Yeah, the timeline can change drastically depending on what you're selling. An offer for something durable like construction materials, well, that might stay open longer
Yeah.
than an offer for, say, fresh fruit.
It sounds like there's no like magic formula to figure out commercially reasonable time.
Yeah.
It's all about looking at the specific circumstances.
Yeah, you've got it. It's about context. Courts take this nuanced approach looking at, what's reasonable within a particular industry for particular products.
This really highlights how important clear communication is,
It does.
setting those expectations from the get-go,
Yeah.
so you can avoid ambiguity and
Yes.
potential disputes later on.
Absolutely. Clarity is key. Now, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I wanted to touch on this fascinating historical example that the
Right.
lecture talks about. Market basket exchanges in international trade.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
This is where countries essentially bartered goods based on a pre-agreed value.
Exactly. It's remarkable, how trade was conducted before modern financial systems.
And what's even more surprising is that
Yeah.
this system is still used today, at least a little bit.
It is.
Can you guess what commodity is often traded using this method?
I don't know.
So I think something universally needed.
Okay.
But that doesn't involve like a direct currency exchange. Is it
We
oil?
got it. Oil is often traded on this market basket basis.
That's incredible. So it shows how even ancient trading practices can still be relevant
They can.
in today's global economy. It's
Yeah.
like, a blast from the past meeting the demands of the present.
Exactly. History often repeats itself, and it's fascinating to see how these old methods can be adapted and reimagined to fit modern needs.
Yeah.
This actually leads perfectly into our next segment, where we're going to explore some of the unique legal challenges that arise in specific industries like international shipping and intellectual property. Buckle up, it's about to get even more interesting.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the world of international contracts. We've already uncovered some pretty tricky stuff, like the mirror acceptance rule and how time zones can turn a simple deadline into a legal nightmare.
It's true. The global marketplace, well, it just adds this whole new layer of complexity.
Right. So now we're going to zoom in on some of the challenges
Okay.
that are specific to certain industries.
Yeah.
In your notes, you mentioned some fascinating scenarios
Yeah.
in the shipping industry.
Yes. When you've got goods crossing borders, well, there are just all sorts of things that can go wrong, and that's where force majeure comes in.
Okay. I've heard that term before,
Yeah.
but I'm not really sure what it means. Is it like a get out of jail free card?
Well, not
Hey, look at
exactly.
the contracts.
Force majeure refers to these unexpected events that kind of, disrupt a contract. Things like natural disasters, political upheavals, even pandemics. It's basically acknowledging that sometimes situations are just beyond anyone's control.
So if a shipment gets delayed because of a hurricane
Right.
or like a sudden trade embargo pops up,
Yes.
maybe the parties can use force majeure to avoid penalties.
Exactly. It's a way of saying, hey, we planned for everything we could, but this was totally out of left field. But it's important to remember that the specific events that qualify
Yeah.
as force majeure are often open to interpretation and can vary,
Yeah.
depending on the contract, where you are in the world.
So it's not a foolproof solution. You can't just shout force majeure and make all your problems disappear.
Exactly. That's why it's crucial to have really clear language in your contracts
Yeah.
that define exactly what a force majeure event is and what each party needs to do if one occurs. Think of it as a safety net, but one with very specific
That
instructions.
makes sense. Now, your notes also mentioned something about like allocating risk in
Yes.
shipping contracts. What does that mean?
It's all about figuring out who's responsible. If something happens to the goods during transit, so, imagine a container falls overboard
Oh,
or
gosh.
gets damaged in a storm. Who takes the financial hit?
That's a good question. I know I've seen those acronyms like FOB and CIF on
Yeah.
shipping documents,
Right.
but I've never really understood what they mean.
Well, those are actually key terms that relate to risk allocation. So FOB stands for free on board,
Okay.
and it means the seller is responsible for the goods until they're loaded onto the ship at the
Yeah.
port of origin. Once they're on board, the risk transfers to the buyer.
So if something happens before the goods are loaded, that's the seller's problem.
Right.
But once they're sailing, it's the buyer's headache.
Precisely. Now, CIF stands for cost, insurance, and freight.
Okay.
And it's a bit different. Here, the seller is actually responsible for the cost and risk of transporting the goods all the way to the destination port. They even arrange for insurance.
So CIF sounds less risky for the buyer then,
Yeah.
because the seller is handling more of the logistics.
Yeah, that's generally true, but CIF usually means a higher price. It's a trade-off.
Right.
Buyers need to think about their risk tolerance
Yeah.
and negotiate terms that make sense for them.
It's amazing how many factors you need to consider
I know, but it's a
when
lot.
you're shipping goods internationally.
It's like this giant chess game where each move can affect the outcome. And this brings up another really important point: getting expert legal advice when you're drafting these agreements. A small oversight, even a tiny ambiguity in the language, can have huge financial consequences later on.
So it sounds like having a good lawyer is as essential as having a good ship captain. Okay, shifting gears a bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about intellectual property rights. I know this is a big deal for businesses that operate globally.
Absolutely. Protecting your trademarks, patents, and copyrights across borders, well, it can be a real minefield.
Oh, I bet. What are some of the biggest challenges?
One of the biggest hurdles is that intellectual property rights are territorial. Just because you have a trademark registered in one country doesn't mean it's automatically protected everywhere else.
So let's say I have a successful clothing brand here in the US
Right.
with a registered trademark. Does that mean I can stop someone in, say, France from using the same name and logo?
Not necessarily. You would probably need to register your trademark in France
Oh, okay.
to have legal grounds to stop someone from copying your brand there. It can be a hassle,
Yeah.
but it's essential to protect your brand,
Yeah.
especially in new markets.
So building a global brand isn't just about marketing and sales, it's also about navigating all these different legal systems.
Exactly. Now, patents are similar. If you invent something groundbreaking, you can't just assume that your US patent will stop someone in, say, Japan
Right.
from copying your invention.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster. Are there any international agreements that make this process a little easier?
There are.
Yeah.
The Patent Cooperation Treaty, or PCT, streamlines the process of applying for patents in multiple countries. It's kind of like a one-stop shop for international patent applications.
So does that mean one PCT application gives me worldwide patent protection?
Not quite. It just simplifies that initial filing process, letting you designate a bunch of countries with one application. However, each country will still do its own examination and make the final decision about whether to grant you a patent.
So it's more like a fast track to get your invention reviewed by different countries, not a guarantee of global protection.
That's a great way to put it. Now, copyrights are a bit different. There's more international harmonization thanks to agreements like the Berne Convention.
So, if I write a book or compose a song,
Yeah.
I can expect some copyright protection in most countries.
Generally, yes. The Berne Convention basically sets a minimum standard of protection for authors in all the member countries.
So, if someone in Brazil tries to pass off my song as their own,
Yeah.
I might have some legal options.
You probably would. However, it's still a good idea to register your copyright in those key markets,
Oh,
especially if you're concerned about infringement. It strengthens your legal position and makes enforcement easier.
it seems like navigating this world of international intellectual property rights is like playing a global game of whack-a-mole. As soon as you protect your work in one place, another problem pops up somewhere else.
It's a good analogy. It takes vigilance, planning, and definitely some expert legal guidance to make sure your creations are protected.
It's incredible how contract law is intertwined with so many different
I
industries
know, it's everywhere.
and touches so many aspects of global business. It's like a hidden language governing how goods, services, and ideas move around the world.
It really is. And you can see we've only just scratched the surface here. There are so many other legal things to consider in international business.
Okay, well, on that note, let's take a quick pause. When we come back, we'll wrap up our deep dive with some key takeaways and a few final thoughts to help you navigate this exciting and sometimes daunting world of international contracts.
Sounds good.
Don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Welcome back. We've been on quite a journey, haven't we? Through the twists and turns of international business contracts. I mean, from the mere acceptance rule to force majeure, and even like a little trip back in time with those market basket exchanges.
Right. It really makes you realize how much we just take for granted when we're making those, like, you know, simple everyday agreements.
Yeah.
You know, add in international borders, cultural differences, industry jargon, and suddenly it's a whole different ballgame.
Exactly. So for anyone out there who is maybe, you know, dipping their toes into the global marketplace for the first time, what are some of the key things they should remember? Like, what's the TLDR of all this?
I think the biggest takeaway is you really got to sweat the small stuff. I mean, every word, every clause, every comma in an international contract, it matters.
Hmm.
What might seem like a minor detail in a, you know, like a domestic deal, well,
yeah.
It can have huge consequences when you're dealing across borders.
So it's not just about understanding the language, it's understanding the legal context and the cultural nuances too, right?
Absolutely. What might be standard practice in one country could be totally baffling in another. You've got to do your research,
yeah,
and get that expert legal advice specific to the countries you're working with, almost like, you know, hiring a local guide.
Oh, that's a great analogy. And we also talked about how important clarity is, you know, avoiding ambiguity. I mean, mm-hmm. even something as simple as close of business or next Wednesday, well, that can create confusion.
Oh, it can.
When you have different time zones involved.
Yeah, specificity is key. Always, yeah. always include those precise dates, times, and time zones. And try to avoid using industry jargon that might not translate well.
Yeah. Or that it has a different meaning in other countries.
And as tempting as it might be, resist that urge to rely on those free online translation tools.
Oh, yeah. They're great for, like, you know, casual conversations.
Yeah, for understanding a menu.
Exactly.
But for legal documents, you need a professional.
A small mistranslation could have massive consequences.
It's definitely worth investing in a professional who gets the nuances of both languages and the legal terms.
Now, another big takeaway was managing risk. Right. We talked about how those terms like FOB and CIF.
Yes.
Well, they can shift the responsibility for the goods.
They can.
During international shipping.
Choosing the right terms can really make a difference in who's going to bear the cost if something goes wrong.
Yeah. Buyers and sellers have to think carefully about their risk tolerance and negotiate terms that, you know, protect their interests.
Absolutely. And when it comes to intellectual property, well, think global.
Okay.
But act local.
So just because you have a trademark or a patent in one country, that doesn't mean you're automatically protected everywhere else.
Nope. You need to file for protection in each country where you want to do business.
You know, it sounds like navigating international contract law is a bit like playing a game of global chess.
It is.
You got to think several moves ahead.
It's a game of strategy.
Right.
And those who understand the rules and play strategically, well, they're the ones who succeed.
So the overarching theme here is really don't underestimate the complexities of doing business internationally. Do your homework, get that expert advice, and be prepared to adapt.
Well said. And you know, the legal landscape, it's constantly changing. New technologies, new trade agreements, new challenges are popping up all the time. You got to stay informed and adaptable.
Here's a final thought for everyone to consider. What role do you think technology will play in the future of these international contracts? Could something like blockchain technology make these agreements more secure, more transparent across borders? It's an exciting time to be in business, and understanding these legal complexities is more important now than ever. Thanks for joining us in this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure. Until next time, happy deal making.